Well, recession has passed, the economy is growing, money is flowing again, and as so often happens, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the marks of the affluent society are clear. The property market is strengthening. Second homes are becoming more common. The rules are being relaxed to encourage 7-day-a-week trading. Sexual immorality, alcohol consumption is growing, along with corruption and fraud. I am, of course, describing the 8th century BC society of King Jeroboam II, into which Amos was speaking. Not everything about it had echoes with our 21st century society here in London. There were differences. The churches were full. Religion was thriving. But then, as now, the church had absorbed much of the culture of the day. That then is the economy thriving, church thriving, complacent prosperity, the world in which Amos finds himself. And understand this, he's not a minister. He's more of a businessman. You see how the book opens up. The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, not just a shepherd from Tekoa, probably a sheep owner and not just a sheep carer. As we'll see, he's a vivid commentator. The words of Amos, literally, which he saw concerning Israel. God gave him vivid pictures to put his message across with. But he is speaking to a country riddled with prophets, with professionals, and he comes as an amateur. A layman who'd never been to Bible college, and he preaches to the clergy of his day. Worse still, as you know, the nation had long been divided into two countries. Judah with its two tribes, the smaller kingdom to the south, Israel with the 10 tribes up to the north. And ever since they'd split, relationships had been understandably strained. The best they'd managed had been peaceful coexistence. And Amos is from Tekoa, down south, and he's speaking to Israel up north. Wrong background. Wrong accent. Wrong message as well. I guess you'd sum it up like this: if God is against us. Only actually there's no if for Amos. Now, we know the opposite line, don't we? The line Paul gives us in Romans 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? A line written to reassure nervous Christians of a confidence they can rightly have in God. But Amos goes the other way round. Amos asks the other question, if God is against us, hey, what does that look like? What does that feel like to have God against you? I'm not sure we can actually enter into that terribly easily, because we live in a day and age where we have domesticated God so much that he's so tame, it's hard to twitch when you hear about a God who's against us. When our kids were very small and we used to go on holiday down Essex Way, one of the day out treats we would have would be to Colchester Zoo. And I can remember one day we'd been there most of the day and we just stayed on for feeding time for the lions. And we went to the lion's enclosure, and there was a kind of barrier about a couple of yards from the fence, and I was there. I got one of the kids on my shoulders, I remember. The other two were by my side, and we watched the lions prowling round their enclosure. And you know how they know it's feeding time for the lions coming up as well, and they were prowling around, you know, muscles rippling as they just went round the edge of the enclosure. And then all of a sudden, as we all kind of watched sweetly these things going round, one of them stopped. And he turned, and he got up on his rear paws and held the cage, and he roared, and everyone stepped back. Well, apart from me, I remained cool, of course. As the kids rushed to me, you know, I was fighting the inner panic and reassuring myself there was a 15-foot fence still intact between us. But it was a healthy reminder that not even zoos can truly domesticate the big cat. And we can't domesticate God. Now, look at verse 2. The lion roars, no, the Lord roars, but it is a lion's roar from Zion and thunders from Jerusalem. It's ominous, isn't it? The pastures of the shepherds dry up and the tip of Carmel withers from Jerusalem down south to Carmel in the far north. We're going to hear of a God who's against us. We're going to hear of God's judgment. And the God who speaks is the God of the nations. It's very striking as Amos begins his message, how he does it. If you look at the map and there he is in Israel speaking, he begins by speaking God's judgment against the nations and the city that surround Israel, many of her enemies. So if you were to read through chapter 1, it's against Damascus, it's against Gaza, it's against Tyre, it's against Edom, it's against Ammon, it's against Moab. That's a great way to get the audience on your side almost, isn't it? You know, as God points out what's wrong with all the countries that are really your enemies anyway. You kind of imagine some a stereotypical Eurosceptic meeting, can't you? And the speaker begins by saying, what's wrong with all the countries on the continent? You know, Romania and Hungary and Germany and France. And the Brits are loving it. And the God of the nations speaks out. And what these nations have in common, of course, is... As Amos speaks about them, they don't have a Bible. They haven't had special revelations from God. And yet they're not beyond his reach. They're not beyond the authority of this God. They can't hide behind whatever they want to call themselves, from Islamic State to secular society. And of course, as God speaks judgment into them, you realize these are times when God's judgment is good. When we've no quibbles with what he points out about them, they're often kind of war crimes, crimes against humanity, the sort of thing the International Court at The Hague would have people for, kind of threshing a whole people, like running a combine harvester over a field without any thought of the collateral damage. There's ethnic cleansing, as whole communities are wiped out or sold off. There are pregnant women slashed open. Now, here are crimes, sins. You don't need the specific details of a particular holy book to tell you they're wrong. Any more than you need that to tell you that shooting tourists sunbathing on a Tunisian beach is wrong. Actually, this opening chapter, as he goes round these nations and states, is a wonderfully vivid example of what Paul writes about in Romans 2, about how those who are without the law will be judged without the law, because we show at times where the law is written on our hearts and it's in our consciences, and we know it's wrong, and we still do it. In fact, the only reason why we hesitate about God's judgment being good is, why hasn't he acted earlier? But as you read through, you'll discover this is the time when God's patience runs out. Each judgment is introduced by for three sins of, and even four. And although he only names one specific, the fourth, so to speak, you realize that this isn't a God who sort of goes one slip and zap. No, this has been coming for a long while. What you hear of as the fourth is just the straw that broke the camel's back. We discover that God may be patient. Patient beyond our imagining, patient beyond our patience. But he's not spineless. Now, he's acting now. It's like that moment. Can you remember back when you were a teenager? Bigger effort for some of us than for others. But that moment when you kind of, you know, you were letting rip and you suddenly realized you'd gone too far. You know, you just saw it in your parents' eyes. And you can't bring it back even if you wanted to, and your kind of only hope is to sort of flee the room and slam the door behind you. We've come to one of those moments when God's patience has run out. And we discover as you read through chapter 1 again and again, it ends with a God who acts in the here and now. Someone said to me the other day, I don't believe in a God who interferes. Happy enough to believe in a God, but not one who really actually interferes in this world, in here and now life. But this God does. Oh, his interference may be hidden in the ebb and flow of military battles and conquests. But if you want to understand why this has gone wrong and why that's happened, well, he explains to every nation, I will break this down. I will send the fire. It may be other nations that are his instrument. But he's the one they've offended, and he's the one who's acting. The God of the nations. Well, we say we understand that, but of course, we're different really, aren't we? We're the Christian end. I think, yeah, no, you need to just read on in chapter 2 and read about the God of his chosen people. Because you see, as Amos does a tour of God's judgment, suddenly it all gets closer to home. And having gone round the surrounding nations, then he begins to finger Judah. It's a bit like we come off the continent and cross the channel, and now God starts to point the finger at the Celtic nations and the English smile. And nothing could endear him to his northern audience better than to hear why God would judge Judah in the south. And then the smile gets wiped from their face as they discover the longest charge sheet is against Israel herself. And when we listen to the charges, we're breathing rather different air here. We're in different territory. What are their sins? Well, they've rejected the law of the Lord, verse 4, and not kept his decrees. They've indulged in idolatry, and they've been led astray by false gods, and these two go together. See, if you're led astray by false gods and false ideologies, you'll discover that you reject the law of the Lord and don't keep his decrees. If you actually build a society that ignores God's laws and decrees, you'll find yourself sooner or later following false spiritualities. Oh, the specifics as they're worked out come in oppression in verses 6 to 8. You sell the innocent for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. People are just economic units. And when that starts to happen, well, you trample on the poor and you deny them justice in the courts. And when you treat people as things, well, this patriarchal society in which men were meant to protect the women just becomes an excuse for sexual exploitation. Father and son use the same girl, we're told. And here's a nation that's ignoring its history, turning its back on all that God has done for them in the past, forgotten what's made them the nation they are today. They reject the spiritual leaders God raises up for them in verses 11 and 12. And you see at the end of verse 12, they command the prophets not to prophesy. It's not too unthinkable. I was reading this week of a street preacher who got in a debate with someone on the street, and the judge in the court case said to him, "You should not have used that Bible verse." You wonder how many other Bible verses, if the judge knows them, he would say, "You mustn't speak in public." And there are churches and denominations where there are Bible truths that it gets harder and harder to speak in public forums. And they face inescapable judgment. Verse 16, even the bravest warriors will flee naked on that day. Our Prime Minister David Cameron likes to say from time to time that we are still a Christian country here. I mean, it's debatable in the present. I would have thought it's undeniable in terms of our history. But of course, it provides no escape from this, does it? If we're a Christian country, then those to whom much is given, of them much is expected. We actually face all the closer scrutiny from this God. We can't hide behind being a Christian country. We can't hide behind being in a Christian church. Judgment, Peter reminds us in his first letter, begins with the household of God. And we can't hide in a church of so many denominations where the history has undeniably included both economic and sexual exploitation. The Lord roars, and only a fool isn't listening. The God of the nations, the God of His chosen people. Here is the God of judgment who comes more and more into focus as we reach chapter 3. He's a God of love, but of a love that punishes in verses 1 and 2. Amos acknowledges who he's speaking to. Look how chapter 3 begins. Hear this word, people of Israel, the word the Lord has spoken against you and against the whole family I brought up out of Egypt. Amos knows Israel's history, the extraordinary history of God's family. And God says, verse 2, you only have I chosen of all the families of the earth. It was an extraordinary choice. Almost unbelievable, wasn't it? I mean, such a strange match. Happens sometimes, doesn't it? You see a couple and they start going out together. They maybe even get engaged. And you look at them and you're scratching your head and you're saying, what on earth does he see in her? You know, or it may be the other way around just as much. You know, what on earth made her go out with him? And, you know, sometimes you get there, it's too far gone, there's no point in saying anything. All you can do is shrug and say, well, time will tell. And it's like that with God and Israel. What on earth did he see in them? He said, well, time will tell, and it has. It has. This wasn't just infatuation. God loved his people. And when the relationship was threatened, he stood by them. And when they found themselves in slavery in Egypt, he engineered the rescue and brought them home. And many times he could have said, I told you so, and said, enough's enough, the way they treated him, but he went on loving. And now he speaks out. You only have I chosen of all the families of the earth, therefore I will forgive you for all your sins. Well, that's probably what I would have written. It's not actually what the Bible says, is it? Have a look at verse 2. Look at it properly. You only have I chosen of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your sins. I mean, do you see the logic? Clearly the love that has gone with them for so long is not weak. God is roaring at his own people. His love is far fiercer than we imagine, and being tolerant of sin is a far more serious thing than we allow ourselves to think. The concept of love here is vastly different from what's popular today. Someone said to me just recently, spoilt children happen when children are given too much love and not enough discipline. Well, in the sense in which he meant it, he's probably right. What is striking is that when God uses the word love in the Bible, it involves discipline. God's love is fiercer than we imagine, and we can't hide our blatant sins under the cloak of being one of the family. And please, don't write this off as Old Testament talk. It's repeated in the New Testament as well. The writer to the Hebrews, writing to wobbly Christians, gives them what he calls a word of encouragement. And he says, my son, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. And don't lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves and punishes everyone he accepts as a son. God's love is not license for us to grow into spoiled children. The Israel of Amos's day couldn't turn their backs on God's law and follow the laws of false gods with impunity. God cares for his family and longs for them to stay his family. Our thought that we can do what we like and still belong to the family doesn't come from knowing him. But it can be breathtaking in its arrogance sometimes. I came across someone who had that extraordinary confidence. He had just left his wife, gone to live with the mistress he'd been having an affair with. And he said, well, if it is a mistake, he's sure the Lord will forgive. But this God says, you only have I chosen of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your sins. I must face a God whose love will discipline me. I must face a God whose warnings give opportunity. As you read verses 3 to 8, you find there's a kind of before and after in many of these verses. See, look at verse 4. It asks, does a lion roar in a thicket when he has no prey? Well, of course not. He's not practicing his scales. You know, he's about to pounce. That's the before. Does he growl in his den when he's caught nothing? No, that's the after. It's the contented growl of a full stomach. Or verse 5 asks, does a bird swoop down to a trap on the ground when there's no bait? Well, of course not. What kind of bird is that? That's the before. And moments later, does a trap spring up from the ground if it hasn't caught something? No, of course not. It's got the bird. It's over. Verse 6. When a trumpet sounds in a city, won't the people tremble? Well, yes, because it's a warning. The enemy's at the gates. And the next minute, well, disaster comes. Verse 6. It's over and God's caused it. But Amos begins this section in verse 3 with a little riddle, doesn't he? Do two walk together unless they've agreed to do so? Almost certainly, the prophet's reminding us of God and his people. That we can't just turn up and walk out with a holy God. We need an agreement, an appointment. And Amos was telling Israel, you're God's people because of the agreement, the covenant between you. And yet it lies in tatters, in shreds, the way you've been acting. You're a split second from disaster. Will we read on and find it's all over? Well, not quite. You see, verse 8 says, the lion has roared, who will not fear? God has spoken, who can but prophesy? God warns before it is over. His goodness is astonishing. Verse 7 says, surely the sovereign Lord does nothing without revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets. God's warnings can be very chilling, but they're intentionally merciful. We are to fear, but that's so that we can be rescued. Now, it's like the shout from the police, isn't it? Arm police, stand still. Well, one false move and the next sound you'll hear will be the shot and the bullet coming towards you. The lion has roared, but it isn't over yet. In his mercy, he sent his prophet to explain the present in the light of the future. You know, the present can look very different when you see the future. Here they are in their growing wealth, in their security, in seemingly spiritual riches, and he's saying, round the corner, there's disaster. You need to re-examine the present. Let me say, I've been in ministry for several decades now. About the most heartbreaking thing you find is people not listening to warnings. When people have been faced with an issue and harden their heart and close their eyes and walk away. Warnings not listened to, opportunities not taken. And as he finishes his introduction, Amos reveals what's coming next in verses 9 to 15, a justice that will be seen to be done. So in verse 9, assemble the nations to see how seriously they need to take God. To see how God doesn't just operate behind closed doors for his favourites. When it's a nation that's gone wrong, it's very public. He says, verse 10, you don't know how to do right, you who store up in your fortresses what you've plundered and looted. You get the sense of security, don't you? They've got the money, however they've got it, by honest or dishonest means, and it's all very secure because it's in their bank accounts, and they won't be Greek banks. It'll be in their sort of offshore tax haven somewhere. He says, you don't know how to do right, do you? You are materially very wealthy and morally very impoverished. Now, isn't that increasingly us in the West? Verse 12. Here's the aftermath of what's going to happen if you don't take the opportunity. As a shepherd, he knows what he's talking about, as a shepherd rescues from the lion's mouth two leg bones and a piece of ear. You know, there's a scuffle on the edge of the flock there, and by the time he gets there, that's all he can find. Not a leg of lamb as we think of it as a joint, just the leg bones. And a scrap of ear. I mean, that's all you know to tell you there was a lamb there before. Well, it'll be like that for Israel. Only all that'll be discovered from her will be the head of a bed and a piece of fabric from the couch. Just a few scraps of their opulence and wealth. And notice in verses 13 to 15, the judgment will remove both wealth and false gods. I'll destroy the altars of Bethel, and I'll remove the winter house and the summer house. That's the second home, the holiday villa. Sorry, that's gone too. Don't imagine that Amos will be content if somehow or other we restore economic equality without returning to God. Well, here's this prophet. And here's the God, our God, he speaks of. And I'm sorry, really, because it's a bad choice of book for August, isn't it? I mean, August is summer, it's holiday time, you want to relax, you want something warm and cuddly, sort of an entertaining read. I'm afraid this won't really replace John Grisham, Lee Child, whatever. You'll have to read those another time. But he speaks to our country, doesn't he? Speaks to our church. Speaks to us. But before you head back into the sun, before you allow all the latest statistics about economic growth to reassure you, let me encourage you to have the right fear. Just a story I was told just this week about a city bank. And a little while back, they introduced a rule saying that anyone who takes a personal call on their mobile while they're on the trading floor will be fired. And 2 days later, someone took one. And he was fired. He'd had several years working for the firm, and they said to him, "Didn't you hear what we said?" He said, "Yes, but I..." He was fired. 10 days later, someone else took a call, and he was fired. And the employee of the bank said, "We believe the bank means it now." Well, God doesn't cry wolf either. The lion has roared. Who will not fear?